We'd gotten to the book of Obadiah, small book, smallest book in the Hebrew Bible, and so it's a small book. It's amazing the messages in that book, though, given its smallness. There are several things to consider. It, of course, like others of the minor prophet books, it has to do with judgment, so it's a judgment book. The difference is, we've been studying, when we studied in Hosea, Amos, Joel, we see judgments against nations that just almost always include Judah and Israel. Obadiah's book does not condemn, even though the time frame would be such that there would be reason to do it, his purpose is not to condemn Judah or Israel. This book is about the little nation of Edom. And the main story of the book, the main lesson of the book, has to do with Edom's treatment of his brother, what is called his brother. So before we get into details of the study, I want to set before you what we're talking about here. His brother was Jacob. His brother was Jacob because Edom, the nation of Edom, were the descendants of Esau. Which reminds us, takes us all the way back in our Bibles to Genesis chapter 25 and Rebekah being pregnant with those two boys, those two twins, Jacob and Esau. And a struggle that the babies had in their mother's womb, and a prenatal struggle that continued all the days of the existence of the nation of Edom, Esau's descendants. And they had gotten to a point where they basically raged against Jerusalem and against Israel. And this really had to do with the history of the nation. So we're going to get into that, but keep in mind the book of Obadiah is a study, really, of the people of Edom. Their crimes were many. We'll get into a list of those. But the main offense of the people of Edom happened when the Babylonians invaded Judah. When the Babylonians attacked Jerusalem, rather than coming to their aid, and I know many preachers, I know I've done it many times, used verse 11 of Obadiah, the little book of Obadiah, to make the point of not coming to the aid of those who you were to defend or help. And so they failed to come to the aid of their brother Jacob. Not only did they refuse to come to the aid of Jacob when Babylon attacked, they also helped out in pillaging and plundering and stealing from the city. Obadiah also tells us that not only did they do those things, he said that they refused to allow passage for refugees who were trying to escape from Jerusalem. And so their crimes were great. They would be ended as a nation. And so that's what we will be studying. Before we get into that, often when we think of an introduction to a study, you think in terms of the author. And in this case, in many cases, you'll see where there is a name that was a common name that may refer to several different people at different places in the Bible, or none of them. And that may be the case with Obadiah. The word, the name Obadiah, is found 12 places in the Old Testament. It's highly likely that the Obadiah, who is the author of the prophet, book Obadiah, is none of these. Some believe that maybe it could be the Obadiah who was Ahab's servant. You remember when Elijah went looking for Ahab, he said, "I'm going to see him today." And he came across the servant Obadiah, and Obadiah, you remember, had some reservations. He said, "Now what's going to happen if I find him and I prepare him to meet with you, and then the Spirit, you know, carries you off somewhere, and now I'm left high and dry?" And he said, "No, I'm going to see him today," Elijah said. But some think that it may be him. That would be 1 Kings 18:3 and a few verses following there that talk about Obadiah, who hid the servants of the Lord in caves by 50 to hide them from Jezebel, an honorable man, and other spokesman for God. Some say this would be one of the teacher class that were appointed by Jehoshaphat to teach in 2 Chronicles 17, verse 7. You can't prove any of that. There's nothing definite to prove that. Those are just conjecture. We don't know that. And so really, we don't know for sure anything about Obadiah except for what we have right here in this little book. We can learn some things from him from that. This also connects to the running debate about the date of writing of the book of Obadiah. That's amazing to me how much corroborative evidence there is for the book of Obadiah. The section in Jeremiah chapter 49, verses 7 through 22, which is Jeremiah's judgment against Edom, contains many similarities to things you read in the book of Obadiah. Then what Thad just read, and since you may have not remembered what I was going to preach on or made these connections tonight, when Thad read that text, you may have wondered, what's Tim doing tonight, if that's intended for the sermon. Ezekiel 25, 12 through 14 also kind of fits inside the book of Obadiah. So as far as corroboration, there's a lot of evidence, a lot of support for the book of Obadiah. Though there is a mystery about the timing of this. Some say there were at least three different invasions of Jerusalem. 2 Chronicles 21 talks about one by the Philistines. 2 Chronicles 24 talks about one by the Syrians. 2 Chronicles 36 then, of course, talks about the one by the Babylonians, which was the most significant. It's when the temple was destroyed. I lean heavily towards that, though I do believe in the early date of the book. So the judgments are pronounced hundreds of years ahead of when they were fulfilled. This is true prophecy. In case you wonder about, you know, how could it be that if he wrote back in the era of Amos, or which, you know, you think of 850 B.C., or like that, how could he be talking about things that happened in 600 A.D. easily? In, for example, the book of Psalms, in Psalm chapter 137, David talked about Edom. And he talked about Edom saying, and he quotes Edom here, people of Edom, saying, raise it, R-A-Z-E, the city of Jerusalem. So that fits perfectly with the book of Obadiah, and yet David wrote 1,000 years before the time of Christ. So we think most scholars put the book where it is in your Bible. Some say Obadiah ought to be after Malachi, because they say it's talking about some things related to the intertestamental period. That, to me, cannot work for some obvious reasons, and we'll see some of those reasons just here in the sermon tonight. The connection to Amos is pretty concrete. In Amos chapter 1 and verse 11, where it talks about the anger of Edom against Jerusalem and against Judah that turned into just a rage and wrath, an abiding wrath against them. And in chapter 9 and verse 12, Amos's judgment against Edom fits very well with the book of Obadiah, which makes it, I think, fit into these earlier books. And when you think of the layout of the common Bible, Old Testament Bible, I believe the book is right where it ought to be. The more I've read about this and studied about it, I think it's right where it ought to be. It is one of seven Old Testament books that are not quoted in the New Testament. One of the only seven. The others are Nahum, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Song of Solomon, and Ecclesiastes. Not directly quoted in the New Testament. And I mentioned these other passages a minute. If you're taking notes and didn't keep up with when I was mentioning these, it's Jeremiah 49, verses 7 through 22, that really echoes many things in the book of Obadiah, and Ezekiel 25, 12 through 14. And you can prove, this is an example of a book corroboration. It's an evidences argument. You know, the argument could be made, if we really don't know who Obadiah is, or if we don't know the date of the writing, how do we know the book is valid? Well, we know the book is valid because it's quoted And it's referred to by these other books that are very clearly attested to. So that's proof in and of itself. For example, Jeremiah 49 to me is amazing to read that. After, if you just read the little book of Obadiah, well, you don't have to read the whole thing. Just read the first 11 to 14 verses of Obadiah. And then skip right over to Jeremiah 49 and read verses 7 through 22 or so of it. It's pretty amazing, pretty remarkable, the similarities. Or between it and the book of Joel. In Obadiah verse 10, he talks about the reason for the judgment being because of violence. This is the same term used in Jeremiah, in Joel chapter 3 and verse 19. Or Joel 3 verses 4 through 7 contain these words, "Your deed shall return on your own head." Very clearly similar to Obadiah verse 15. Or in, again in Obadiah verse 15, "The day of the Lord is near." I remembered this very expression when we studied Joel. We saw that in Joel repeatedly. That seems to tie him in time frame in the era to Joel and to these other books. In Mount Zion, this to me is conclusive, "There shall be those who escape." That's not something you read everywhere in the Old Testament. But that's what Joel said in Joel chapter 2 and verse 32. Obadiah said it in verse 17. So there are, so we shouldn't be have any reservations about the authenticity of the book of Obadiah. The technical word, the veracity of it, what the canonicity of it, whether or not it belongs in the Bible. I don't think there's any question about that whatsoever, and these passages prove that. One more, Obadiah verse 17, compared to Joel chapter 3 and verse 17, "Zion shall be holy." Book of Obadiah is clearly divided into two parts, verses 1 through 14 and then 15 through 21. And these sections, you deal with judgment against the nation of Edom, the people of Esau, what is also called Mount Seir, S-E-I-R. I was talking to Lloyd, I can't remember what brought this up. Lloyd, we're talking about living on a hill. I said, Lloyd and Debbie are probably happy to be living like Daryl and Julie over there living on the hill right now. And I was talking about, I'm going to talk about that a little bit tonight, because one of the cities that belong to Edom continues to be a very famous place, Petra. The Old Testament word Selah, the city, S-E-L-A, that was a fortified city in Edom, is also known as Petra. Some of you may be familiar with Petra, the city of Petra, the city that is built into stone face, cliff face. It's sandstone, and so people from ancient times, for thousands of years, have lived in that area and have carved into those sandstone bluffs houses, temples, elaborate temples, things of that nature. So this continues today. That was a city. That was a city of the Edomites. So kind of interesting. But in Genesis chapter 32 and verse 3, when it says the land of Seir, or Seir, S-E-I-R, he's referring here to Edom. The book is a judgment against Edom. And Edom really was a strip of mountains that running about 20 miles wide to 100 miles in length. And so you can think it, the length of it, you really think about when you think of the cities at the bottom of it, the south of it, into the north of it, all the way up to Bozrah. All the way up to Bozrah, and you go all the way down to the city of Dedan. Teman was one of the main cities there, and also, of course, Petra or Selah. And because they were on this mountainous strip, you see references to their pride in the book of Obadiah and also in Jeremiah 49. It talks about their pride dwelling in the cliffs. They were proud, and this sort of led to or bolstered their pride because they were impregnable. No army sufficient to conquer Edom would be able to travel in there. They would be head off at the pass, as we would say. The only way Edom could be conquered because of the fortress nature of that mountain range was if it was done by friends. And that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened. It's exactly what Babylon did to them. Obadiah mentions that it would be one of their allies who would turn against them. Well, they helped the Babylonians. They helped the Babylonians against Judah and Jerusalem during the time of the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem. And then the Babylonians later would turn on them. The Edomites, as I've mentioned before, were the descendants of Esau. This is very clear from the book. You see the reference to Esau, verses 6 and 18 in the little book of Obadiah. The term house of Esau in verses 8, 9, 19, and 21. Also Mount Esau, which is Mount parallel to Mount Seir. Brother of Jacob, verse 10 talks about him basically waylaying his brother. Well, that would be because the Jewish people descended from Jacob. And you think of the 12 tribes and Israel forming from that. And then, of course, Esau going the other way. And eventually, the land of Edom developing from the descendants of Esau. Talked about their fortified cities. As we continue here, this idea of two parts of the book. Amos chapter 1 in verse 11, we studied already some time ago, but Amos also pronounced judgment on Edom, but now his pronouncements were not near as lengthy as what we see here in the book of Obadiah. But there is a verse, a couple of verses of scripture in Amos that speak to this, but there's one in chapter 1 in verse 11 that is very powerful. It's kind of one of those verses you read and it sticks with you a little bit. Verse 11 says, "Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Edom and for four." You may recall that when I went through these judgment passages and it says for three and four, the point of that is just simply emphasis. It's to emphasize what God is doing and the reasons for what he does. For three transgressions and for four, it's a kind of a thoroughness phrase or expression. I will not turn away the punishment thereof because he did pursue his brother. Now, Obadiah is going to say, I'm talking about his brother Jacob, and he specifies. He's pursued his brother with the sword and did not cast off all pity, and his anger did tear perpetually and kept his wrath forever. So, Edom is judged by God because of their attitude. Really, because of their hateful attitude against their brethren. Their hateful attitude against the Jews, against Israel, or you might say Judah in this case. So, the one translation says, his anger tore perpetually and he kept his wrath forever. So, that's according to Amos. That's why this judgment would happen. And I mentioned earlier in Genesis chapter 25 and verse 22, that's the specific verse where it talks about Rebekah being pregnant and the children struggling within her. Then it was explained to her that these children represent two nations that will be at odds with each other. And of course, we're talking about the nation of Israel and the nation of Edom. We got close to this. We got real close recently in our study, going back and looking at Solomon. When we started our study of Ecclesiastes and his programs and activities, economic ventures, trade routes, and all of that, we got pretty close to one of the reasons why the Edomites were very angry with the Jews, because first, David, Solomon's father, conquered Edom. Militarily, forcefully, he conquered them in 2 Samuel 8 and verse 14. It's just briefly mentioned there as one of the conquests. It's amazing to me how sometimes the Bible is like a jigsaw puzzle. And you could be reading something, if your mind maybe is going a different direction, maybe you're focused on the main point of that context, and these little incidentals don't get plugged in. That's happened to me with this passage. And you don't plug these things together. Why is that there? And then you study the book of Obadiah in detail and depth, and you can put this together because it makes perfect sense. They would have been very upset about that. The reference in Numbers 20 and verse 17 to the king's highway is significant as well, because according to 1 Kings 9, 26 through 28, this land was exploited by Solomon in his acquisition of bronze. And they had this area, this hill country, mountainous region, that Edom owned and occupied, were known for mining that. So you have some reasons here why the Edomites may have continued to be very angry with the Jews. You have David and then later Solomon and what he did. This was a part of how he became so wealthy. Let's go through and look. Look at the reasons why God's judgment was brought against him. I mentioned in the introduction to the study of the minor prophets that many of the things you study here are just like reading human nature today, reading how people operate today, the things they do today. And we're going to see that right here in these early verses in the book of Obadiah. So I want us to go through here and see what happened. And I'm going to use my Bible here and go through the verses. In verse 3 of Obadiah, it says, "The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee. Thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, that saith in his heart, who shall bring me down to the ground? Though thou exalt thyself as the eagle, and thou that set thy nest among the stars, thence will I bring thee down, saith the Lord." Okay, so notice some connections here in the book of Obadiah. By the way, it helps to understand the terrain where they live. If you understand that one of their main cities was the city of Petra, then this makes perfect sense. Because you might think, how would anybody be able to do anything to me if I lived there? And really they couldn't. Now you think about the passageways in that area, they were too narrow for massive armies to be able to travel through there and you not know about it. Now if the army traveled through there and they were friends of yours and say, "Hey, we need to pass through here. There's going to be a long caravan of us coming through here. And we're going to be traveling through here for some period of time." And you say, "Yeah, you're welcome to do that. We're friends." And all of a sudden, trouble if they turn on you, which is what happened. That's what the Babylonians did to them. But this led to pride. They thought, "What can people do to me?" So their physical circumstance led to their pride. Now, this is easy, of course, to happen. We this morning, Josh was teaching in the book of Ecclesiastes, and we had occasion, and I think a little bit Wednesday night, of occasion to look at passages like 1 Timothy chapter 6 and other passages that talk about the attitude that one might develop, one can develop as a result of riches. We have a tendency to trust in riches, and the warning is issued against that. We could see ourselves as being impregnable, invincible as a result of wealth. And then all of a sudden, it's fleeting. It's fleeting and it's gone and we're left exposed. So here you have this circumstance was a physical circumstance. That is where they live. And of course, we don't have to, wouldn't have to spend a lot of time or go to a lot of passages in order to be reminded of the dangers of pride. Peter warned against pride in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 6. "Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time." He said that because the end of verse 5 the end of the elder passage there. You have the first few verses of that chapter focused upon elders and their oversight. But the end of verse 5 says, "For God resisteth the proud and giveth grace to the humble." Or pride, what? Goes before destruction. Proverbs 16:18. So the sin of pride is what we're reading about here. Mighty and a haughty spirit before a fall. Solomon continued in Proverbs 16:18. So pride was a problem, but the main sin of these people is identified just a little bit later. It has to do with their attitude. They're being basically inconsiderate, not compassionate for their own kin, their own brothers, their own brother Jacob. You might say no brotherly concern for them. When the Babylonians attack in verses 9 and 10 of the book of Obadiah. Earlier I mentioned Psalm 137. In verse 7, and this is pretty fascinating to think of how long this would have been before, it's still another 150 years before an old book like Obadiah, if it was written around 800 to 850 B.C. David said in Psalm 137, verse 7, "Remember, O Lord, remember against the sons of Edom." Now he's writing several hundred years before God would do anything against Edom. David said, "Remember against the sons of Edom." And the expression that's used here is the day of Jerusalem. Now the expression the day of Jerusalem stands for the day on which it was destroyed. It was struck down. Or the time of, not necessarily just a 24-hour period, but the time of their demise. So he uses this expression long before the Babylonian invasion, and he's speaking here about the attitude of the Edomites, and they're saying, as though it were a song, like the one I mentioned on the radio last week from Jeremiah in chapter 7, where they go into the temple and they sing the little ditty. They sing the little song, you know, "The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord." I thought by their religious exclamation that they would be good with God. Well, that sounds like what's going on here. It says, "Raise it to its very foundation." And I put this verse in my charts and because of this connection. And then I was going back this afternoon rereading these verses because, like I said, I probably forgot 90% of this in the last month. And I was reading this, and I was reading along here and kept reading in Psalm 137. And notice that in verse 8, he says, "O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed." What? Babylon has not yet even been raised up by God to be used as a punitive tool against the Israelites. David, here he's writing it about 1000 B.C., 1000 B.C., talking about the destruction of Babylon, but he's also quoting the Edomites all of these hundreds of years before the demise of Jerusalem, saying what they will say about Jerusalem. These are quite prophetic and quite powerful. Babylon was not even a world power when David said what he did here. He said Babylon's going to be destroyed. So that's interesting. When you think about this idea of the language of Obadiah, let's read verses 9 and 10. He said, "Thy mighty men, O Teman, shall be dismayed, to the end that every one of the mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter. For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever." Verse 11 says, "In the day that thou stoodest on the other side, in the day that strangers carried away captive his forces and foreigners entered into his gates and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast one of them." Even you were as one of them. So he's talking about what the Babylonians did to Jerusalem. He said you were one with them. You consented to it. You were happy that it happened. But it reminds us of the Lord's illustration of what it means to be a neighbor to someone. He raised the question, who is your neighbor in Luke chapter 10? And then he told the story of the what we call the Good Samaritan. But it's the story of a man who was traveling from Jerusalem down to Jericho and fell among thieves. And they stripped him of his clothes and they beat him and left him half dead. And then the rest of the narrative has to do with these three individuals of different backgrounds traveling and walking and seeing him. You had the priest. And what did the priest do when he saw this man from Jerusalem that had been fallen among thieves and had been injured? It says he walked on the other side. He passed by on the other side. And then the Levite. But, well, surely a Levite would be more concerned about someone than that. You think a priest would too. But no, the Levite walked or passed by on the other side. Then the Samaritan, of course, he had compassion on him and wrapped up his wounds and treated him and took him to the motel and said, take care of him. I'll give you money and I'll give you more if you need it later, that if you run into further expenses. So you have the story of Luke chapter 10, but that's what we're reminded of when we think of what Edom did to their brother. They stood by, verse 11 says, they stood by on the other side. Said, you were as one of them. But not only did they do that, they gloated over this. Look at verses 12 and 13 of Obadiah. But thou shouldest not have looked on the day of thy brother and the day that he became a stranger, neither shouldest thou have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction, neither shouldest thou have spoken proudly in the day of distress. Thou shouldest not have entered into the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Yea, thou shouldest not have looked on their affliction in the day of their calamity, nor have laid hands on their substance in the day of their calamity. So they gloated, they looted. We'll see here in a different point. Now, we studied back in the book of Proverbs in chapter 17 and verse 5 about when tragedy strikes other people. Now, what if it happened to people who were like persecutors of the church or abusers of us, or people who had tortured us in the past, and you think, well, I'm happy that happened to them. What did Solomon say our attitude should be about that? To not look favorably upon the calamity of other people. That's a general principle, and they violated that as well. They looted, we read in verse 13. Verse 14 says, neither shouldest thou have stood in the crossway to cut off those of his that did escape. So they wouldn't allow refugees to pass through their territory. Now, these were their brethren that they disallowed that entrance. And then look at their end here. You might say, well, haven't we studied in the minor prophets passages that talk about the end of Judah and Jerusalem, judgments against them? We have. Now, they're always, and also in that, I put together a list of these this afternoon. It's kind of interesting when you look at reunification passages of the Jews. Many times, Hosea chapter 1 and verse 11 does this. There's some passages in Isaiah that talk about after the return of the Jews from Babylon. And I remember a passage that relates this to Hezekiah as well. But after the return of the Jews from Babylon, after the 70 years captivity, it was not just Judah Jews that did that. There were Jews that had been scattered by the Assyrians that got also caught up in the Babylonian superstructure of power, because the Babylonians had conquered the Assyrians. So their possessions now go to the Babylonians. But many of the Israelites also came back to Jerusalem. If you ever study intertestamental history, you'll see this. The guy's name is John Hyrcanus. And John Hyrcanus was the one who pulled together Jews from a lot of different places. So we think of the Jews that went to Babylon in the 70 years captivity, but also Jews that were Israelites that thought, I want to go back to Jerusalem. I want to go back to the homeland. So anyway, you see some of that in connection with Judah and with Israel. But look at the difference here with Obadiah, with what Obadiah says about Edom. Verse 7 says, all the men of thy confederacy, or allies, your Bible may have, be better there, I think, have brought thee even to the border. The men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee. They that eat thy bread, it says, and have laid a wound under thee. Therefore, and that word probably is better translated, snare. Laid a snare. They were close enough to lay a snare under the people of Edom. That's pretty close. Those are your friends. And they had befriended Babylon for some period of time. And Babylon, of course, turned on them. Verse 5 talks about the nature of thievery. So when thieves come through, they're usually in a hurry. They come through, verse 5, and they take what they can, and then they go on. But you will be utterly robbed. Nothing will be left to you, Edomites. That's the nature of your judgment. He is the example of grape gathering in that verse. And he talks about in the end of verse 5. He says, if the grape gatherers come to thee, would they not have some grapes? What were the Jews instructed to do when they harvested their grapes? Leave some of them for the poor of the land. That's Deuteronomy 24:21. And yet, he said, none of these principles, none of these old rules were going to be respected by the Babylonians. They will wipe you clean. So verse 6 says they would be utterly pillaged. You know, you ever wonder what happened to the land of Edom? You can look at Old Testament maps. You can open your Bible right now and find the boundaries of the land of Edom in one of those old maps. You can't do that right now. You can't find Edom on a map. Later, intertestamental period, the Idumeans took over that part of the country. Of course, in those battles where John Hyrcanus and others, the Maccabean revolt era, they took over a lot of that. But no Edomites there, no people of Esau. It's because God had ordained it. Then in the last part of this, verses 15 through 21, some similarities here between some the endings of other books of the minor prophets and major prophets, because then you have a shift to this idea of restoration. Now, Esau would not be restored. Verse 18 says they would be utterly destroyed and will not come back. Verse 17, though, you have this idea of the restoration of Israel. And, of course, there are many debates about this. This is how I got off on this idea of these reunification passages that are scattered, like Hosea 1:11. Very clear. It mentions both Judah and Israel. One of the things I've read about this, though the passages are somewhat scarce, there's a few of them that talk about this. It does appear that there was some effort on the part of many Jews to reunify and to come back to Jerusalem, which apparently happened. But then, of course, the Jews became unfaithful again after the rebuilding of the second temple, the temple of Zerubbabel and Ezra, after the rebuilding of the city walls by Nehemiah. So you think of the books of Ezra and Nehemiah in that period of time. After all of that, the Jews became unfaithful again. And so then we're coasting to, in time, down to the target date of 70 AD, which would be the utter rejection of the Jewish nation by God. But he does, here in these verses, talk about the return of exiles of Judah and Joseph. By the way, it says Joseph. When the term Joseph is used of Israel, it's not just talking about the 10 northern tribes of Israel. It's not just talking about the southern tribe of Judah. It's talking about the whole thing. Joseph is a term in the Old Testament to refer to all of the Jews. But then he said, the kingdom shall be the Lord's. And I would have trouble seeing that any other way but messianic. In other words, this seems to be pointing to the kingdom, not the kingdom of the Jews, not the kingdom of a physical kingdom, but the kingdom that would, inside of which fits the Lord's church. God's overall rule under the New Testament, and then more specifically, the church and the church age. So, small book, but there's quite a bit in the book of Obadiah. We'll move on. In the Old Testament, our Old Testament studies, before we had moved in our adult class studies back to the New Testament, 2 or 3 years ago, Josh, I can't remember how long it's been, but we studied the book of Jonah, and I thought, well, that make me do a lighter work of that, but probably not. We'll probably go ahead and go through and hit the high points on it best we can, the timing and various aspects of that book of Jonah, and then we'll move on through the remaining of the 12 minor prophets. Maybe there's someone here this evening who is not a child of God. You haven't put on Christ in the waters of baptism. What can we learn from something like a book like this? Well, we can learn a lot about behavior. We can learn a lot about attitude. We can learn about blessings and rewards and, sadly, punishments. Do you think about the timing, the dates of some of those plans that God had? If you go back to the days of David, David's writings in the book of Psalms, and see predictions made about the destruction of Babylon and the destruction of Edom, verses side by side in your Bible there. That means that God meant business. When he said he would visit the iniquity of the children unto the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, that would span hundreds of years, what's referenced in as the book of Exodus in chapter 20 in the first few verses there. That would span hundreds of years. And yet God said, this is what I'm going to do. And that's what he did. So when God plans punishment for those who are opposing him, he sticks to that he's going to do it. It's a matter of time. And when he promises blessings and rewards, that's what he does. That's what he does. So we want to be on the receiving end of the blessings and rewards, not on the receiving end of the punishment. Both are certain, equally certain, but one will not be pleasurable. One will not be enjoyable. God's punishments are not enjoyable. They are, as described in the New Testament, tormenting. The rich man said, I am tormented in this flame. We don't want that for you. We don't want that for anyone. Why not avoid that? Put yourself in a position of reaping the benefits, blessings of being a Christian, having your sins washed away. If you need to do that tonight, we're here to help you. Come forward as we stand and sing to encourage you.